Are you concerned about the economic inequality in the U.S. and the gap between the rich and the poor? Our guest this hour is, he's a Nobel Prize-winning economist and author of the new book, The Great Divide, Unequal Societies and What We Can Do About Them. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. How great is the Great Divide and what would it take to bridge it? Why does it matter? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist and the best-selling author of several books, including The Price of Inequality. His latest book is The Great Divide, Unequal Societies and What We Can Do About Them. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Good morning.
Nice to be here.
Why are you so passionate about the great divide between the rich and the poor?
I think it's undermining our society, our democracy, and it's actually weakening our economy. So this is a moral issue, but it's also an economic and a very deeply political issue.
Well, all right. Well, how is it undermining our society?
Well, when you have the divide of the magnitude that we have in the United States, it is very difficult for people to work together. It's one of the reasons why we have such different perceptions, even of reality. Take an issue like global warming. Yesterday was Earth Day. A lot of people focused on what was happening to this Earth, the fact that climate change is real. It's leading to more variability of temperature, of weather, and the science is unambiguous about this, and yet only about 40% of Americans really take seriously the problem of climate change. And it's very different from in other countries. And one of the reasons, it's been very clear that it's so different, is that we live in different universes. Some of the wealthy people live in a world where all their friends believe that there is no such thing as climate change, and that's very different from the universe in which so many other Americans live.
Yeah, and how is it undermining our economy?
Well, that is actually one of the fundamental ways in which our understanding of our economy and of inequality has changed in recent years. Used to be thought that there was a trade-off. There was a problem of inequality, but the only way to reduce inequality was to do things that would actually lead to lower economic growth. Now we understand that if we promote greater equality, we actually can also promote higher growth and better economic performance. And this is not just a fringe view. This is a view that now the International Monetary Fund, tries to look at the performance of economies all over the world, and historically has been very conservative. They've now come to the view that inequality is bad for economic performance, and they've been going around actively telling governments everywhere in the world they need to do something to reduce inequality. And of course, America has the highest level of inequality of any of the advanced countries, and actually has one of the least lowest levels of equality of opportunity.
Put this into some perspective for us when it comes to the United States, the magnitude of the Great Divide.
Well, one way of putting it is that the top 1% garners for itself something between 20% and 25% of all the nation's income. Things got even more dramatic in the years after the Great Recession began. In 2009, the administration, Federal Reserve, announced that the recession was over. But then, in the 3 years following that, 95% of all the increase in income that occurred in our country went to the top 1%. So most of America was experiencing stagnation. And that was reflecting not only what was happening in those 3 years, but what's been happening over a much longer period of time. You know, the striking thing is our GDP, our measure of national income, has been going up year after year, except for the 2008-9 Great Recession. And yet, today, America's middle, it has a lower income than it did a quarter of a century ago. So we have an economy, while it may be growing, is not serving the majority of our citizens.
Yeah. Why do you argue that economic inequality is not in the interest of the 1%, but in the 1% of the 1%?
Well, the basic point that I've been trying to argue is related to what I just said, that when you have a more divided society, the economy doesn't perform as well. And that means that even the 1% or the 0.1% or the 0.01%, it may get a larger share of the national income because of all of these policies that lead to greater inequity. But because the pie is smaller, they actually aren't doing as well as they might if we actually try to create shared prosperity. You know, you go back to the decades after World War II when fighting the war together brought us together. The result of that was, in those decades, our economy experienced the fastest rate of growth, but it was shared prosperity. And then after 1980, we started dividing, we started going apart, and the result of that was our overall economy actually slowed down. And I believe that if we could actually get our economy to start growing again by creating a more shared prosperity, even the people at the top would share in that prosperity.
Yeah. You mentioned that since the recession, 95%, at least the very rich, have recovered. The middle-income people have seen lower wages. What about poverty? Are we seeing increasing poverty in America?
Yes, we are. And one aspect of the poverty that I find most disturbing is the large fraction of the children of America that are growing up in poverty. About 1 in 5 children are growing up today in poverty in America. And why that's so important is that if children don't have adequate nutrition, don't have adequate health care, their future productivity and therefore the country's productivity will be impaired. And this is one of the reasons why America, as I said before, has become among the countries of the advanced world with the least equality of opportunity, which means the life chances of a young American are more dependent on the income and education of his parents than in other advanced countries. So if we have a large fraction of our children growing up in poverty, over 20%, that means a large fraction of our population is not going to be able to live up to their potential.
Yeah. So why did this happen? How come we have this great divide?
Well, there are many factors, but I sort of date the real increase in our divide back to around 1980, where there were a set of ideas were put forward. The 70s were a period of a lot of tumult in our economy, society. Inflation grew very high. People got worried. And a new theory came forward called supply-side economics. And the idea was if you lower taxes at the top, you deregulate, you provide allegedly more incentives to work hard, save more, and more opportunity by reducing the constraints, we'd have faster growth. Yes, the advocates of this idea said we will have more inequality, but even the people in the middle and the bottom will benefit because a rising tide lifts all boat. Trickle-down economics works, they said. You have more money at the top. The people at the top are the job creators, and more jobs will be created, and everybody will benefit. Well, after a third of a century of this, you might call experiment, an experiment that a lot of economists were very, very dubious about, we now know the result. The result is that we have had lower growth, overall. And the people in the middle and the bottom have actually seen stagnation. The only growth that has occurred has been at the top.
We are talking with Joseph Stiglitz. He is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, author of The Great Divide, Unequal Societies and What We Can Do About Them. We will talk about what we can do about them when we return, and we will take your questions and your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. How concerned are you about the great divide, the gap between the very rich and the very poor? We are talking about the great divide with economist Joseph Stiglitz, and you can join in with your questions and your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our lines are full, but let me ask you, Joseph Stiglitz, if we can at least get a start to the solutions. What is the best solution to economic inequality in the U.S.?
Well, there's no magic bullet. You know, we have something that has grown to such an extent over the last third of a century, you're not going to solve it overnight. But I emphasize three aspects of this. A lot of the discussion has been focused on what you might call redistribution, more progressive taxes. And actually, one of the things I point out is that we actually have a regressive tax system. Those at the very top pay a smaller fraction of their income than those with much lower income. So just making our tax system fair would be an important step in the right direction, even better if we can make it progressive. But the second thing is what's sometimes called the predistribution, the determinants of market income. And the problem is that we have all kinds of distortions in the economy, and they're one-sided. There are distortions that increase inequality. We have market power, monopoly power, weakening of the unions, increased power of the CEOs to set their own salaries. So a whole set of it's basically the rules and regulations which determine how the economy functions. You know, the point here is that it's not just economic forces that are driving the inequality in the United States. After all, those economic forces are the same in all the other advanced countries. The fact is that we have more inequality than these other countries, and that's because we've made different choices. We've made different decisions about how we structure our economy. And the third thing that's absolutely important is obviously education, making sure that there isn't undue transmission of advantage from one generation to the other. The fact is that in the United States, the children of the very well-off get a better education. They get more opportunities to go to very good private schools. But even in the public school system, we invest more in the children of the rich than we do in the rest. And so the result of that is that advantages get transmitted across generations, and so too for disadvantages.
Let's take some calls. Angela in Fish Creek is with us first. Hello, Angela.
Good morning. I'm so glad you're talking about this topic. It's something that has come up quite a bit in our community up here in the peninsula, is that we have so many jobs available, and people who don't want to fill them because they'll lose their benefits, they'll lose their health care, they'll lose all the government assistance that they get if they work too much. It's almost become more profitable to be poor than to work and make a decent wage. And in a community where tourism is our biggest source of income, and we have a very, about a six-month peak season up here, and really 4 months is the greater peak of that. It's even hard for people to live year-round. You know, my husband and I, he works remotely for a company in the big city, and so he makes a nicer income. I don't, and we We can't even get assistance programs for some of our everyday, for, you know, some of the community things where other people are getting significant help with those things because it's more profitable for them to do that than to go out to work. And, you know, I'm wondering if there's some things that could be done on the bigger front and the bigger scale to start to make that easier for people. And, you know, I know with the Obamacare and having that more accessible to people, it helps a little. But are there other things that we can do on the bigger scale to start to bring that back and make it so that being poor isn't as viable and that people really want to get out of that as opposed to stay in it because it's easy and it's they can live.
Angela, I'll get our guest to respond in just a moment, but I just want to understand what you are saying. You're concerned that people in Door County aren't taking the service industry jobs that are available, especially during the tourist season, in favor of staying on their public aid.
Correct.
Do you think that they could actually live year-round on those...
I think we could find a way to make it to be profitable because right now it's more profitable to keep getting government assistance for health care, for heating and for those kinds of costs because if they work too much, then that will all be taken away from them.
All right. Joseph Stiglitz, a comment on this?
Well, this charge that there are large numbers of people across the country that are free riding on the rest of us is a view that was widely aired over a long period of time. There was a time people talked about the welfare queen. We reformed the welfare system back in 1996, and when you look carefully at the data, it turns out that this has been greatly exaggerated. If anything, the real problem is that the basic welfare benefits are not enough to live a decent life. So if we had good jobs for people, I am absolutely sure that most people would prefer to work. We've done a lot to help it pay to work. That's why the Earned Income Tax Credit has been a very important mechanism to provide further incentives for people to join the labor force. By and large, overall, for the country as a whole, and I can't speak to the particular problem in the place in that she mentioned, but for the country as a whole, the real problem is lack of jobs. The real problem is that people have looked for jobs for year after year after year, and they get discouraged, quite frankly. And we see that young people, old people, everywhere across the country, that it is the lack of jobs. In fact, one of the ways we can tell something is going wrong with the way the economy is functioning is that there are so many people working at part-time jobs, and you ask them, would you like to work at a full-time job? So they say, yes, there just aren't any full-time jobs. And that's very related to this divided economy, divided society, the great divide that I titled my book, because when there aren't jobs, of course, those who can't get the jobs wind up at the bottom of the economic pyramid, and that and it drives down wages, and it's one of the reasons why the divide has increased so much in the recent years.
Yeah, I know you can't speak specifically to Door County, Wisconsin, but it's a tourist area, and Angela is saying, you know, that there are plenty of jobs, but it's not a lack of jobs that is a problem, but I'm wondering, you know, maybe it's a lack of a living wage paying jobs.
I think that's right, and that feeds into the general discussion that's going on right now around the country. Minimum wage. Minimum wage in the United States is appalling. It's lower than it was close to a half century ago. Now, can you imagine a society in which there's been a half century in which wages have not increased? Of course, for most of our society, wages have increased, but not at the bottom. You know, this is a period, you know, in the last third of a century, China has seen its income increase eightfold. And yet, in the United States, total stagnation at the bottom. In China, 500 million people were moved out of poverty. In the United States, the percentage of people in poverty has actually been going up. So there's something wrong with the way our economy is performing. I do think the kind of discussion that's going on right now, to raise the minimum wage to a more livable wage, still not livable, going from a little over $7 an hour to $12 an hour, makes an enormous sense. And this is another area in which our understanding of economics has changed a lot in the last, say, two decades. It used to be thought that, oh, the people at the minimum wage were mostly teenagers. You raise that minimum wage and people won't hire them and unemployment will go up. Well, in today's world, a very, very large fraction of those working at the minimum wage are the primary bread earner in the family. So they really depend on that. The evidence is overwhelmingly now that there are not the adverse effects on employment. In fact, there is some argument that it may actually help employment because when you raise the wage, it raises the income, they can spend more and increases demand, and it's the lack of demand that is holding back the economy, the economic recovery.
I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, author of The Great Divide, Unequal Societies and What We Can Do About Them. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you would like to join in with a question or a view on this. Joseph Stiglitz argues economic inequality is a choice, and that we can and must do more to address the increasing poverty in America and the abundance of wealth for the extremely rich. You say that income inequality is a choice, and a few of our Facebook followers want to know exactly what you mean by that. Gary writes, economic inequality is a choice? Tell that to public employees in Wisconsin, where their income and benefits are now restricted by state statute. Whose choice is it? Whose choice is it, Joseph Stiglitz?
Of our elected public officials, the way our government has been functioning. So the point when I said it was a choice, it wasn't the choice of the individual. What I was trying to emphasize is that different societies have, in effect, chosen to organize themselves in different ways. It isn't a result of inexorable economic laws, of inevitable economic forces. The economic laws are operating the same on both sides of the Atlantic and all banks countries all over the world, and yet America has wound up with more inequality than these other countries. And you have to ask why, and it's the result of our policies that are a result of our politics, and it's the way our politics have chosen to shape our economy, our society, that have led to all this inequality. Of course, for your public sector employees, I my heart goes out to them because those individuals had absolutely no choice, and he's absolutely right about that. And let me highlight another aspect of this choice about, you know, it's often said, but we can't afford to do more. Take one of the ingredients I was talking about before, that it's determining the level of inequality. And that's access to education. At the end of World War II, we were a much poorer country. At the end of World War II, we had a debt-GDP ratio of 130%, you know, money that we'd borrowed to fight the war, to fight for our survival. And yet, at the end of World War II, we said that everybody who had fought in the war, which was every able-bodied man, a lot of women as well, we could afford to send them to a four-year first-rate college, and that was the GI Bill of Rights, and it contributed to that period of very rapid economic growth that we had after World War II. It contributed to making America the first middle-class society in the world. And then we lost the way. We are now dealing with the consequences. But the point I wanted to make is we could afford to do that. If we could afford to do it in 1945, we could afford to do it now. And it's the way we're making our political decisions.
Let's go next to John in Appleton. Hello, John.
Just want to make a couple of quick comments. Your guest had mentioned the word redistribution. And redistribution is kind of a code word for collectivism. And collectivism at some point leads to communism. Because it doesn't work. At some point you can't run around and take enough people's money to make that work.
Well, hold on, John. Before we get lost with another point, let's get Joseph Stiglitz to respond to that, and then I'll bring you back.
The point I made in the beginning was that we're not actually talking about redistribution. What we're really saying is, should the people at the top pay their fair share of taxes? The people at the very top pay a smaller percentage of their income than those whose income is much lower. People who speculate, whose income derives from land speculation, pay a lower tax rate than those who work hard for a living. And, you know, when you speculate on land, you don't create more land. It's not as if they're making our country more efficient, more productive. In fact, it's diverting resources away from more productive activities. So one of the key points I'm trying to raise is that our tax system is not only unfair, it's distorting our economy and leading to lower economic growth. So what we're talking about here is not taking from the rich and giving to the poor. What we're just saying is those at the top ought to pay their fair share. And the fact is they haven't been.
Yeah. So what do we do with that fair share that the rich pay if we tax the rich more?
Oh, there's a lot that we could do. And that's, a political choice, a choice in our democracy. One of the things that I think very clear, we need to invest more in infrastructure and technology and education, and that would make our economy more productive. We've done studies that show the economic returns to these kinds of investments, and they are very, very high. So that's one thing. Another thing that we could do is take away some of the burden of the taxation on the very poor. We could do things to increase the earned income tax credit to provide more incentives for the people at the very bottom to join the labor force. So there are many things that we could do to make our economy more productive. Mm-hmm. One of the real problems that so many people in our economy face is trying to actually participate actively in the labor market. Women who have, single women particularly, who have children, we don't have child care anywhere near the kind of child care that's provided by many other countries around the world. The result of that is that we have lower rates of labor force participation, less engaged labor force. Even when we pay them fair wages, we make life very difficult for them to be as a productive member of the labor force as others.
Yeah. And so, John, I promised I'd bring you back. Do you have a follow-up?
Well, that all is probably the case. But the simple fact of the matter is there are people in our society that produce, and there's people in our society that don't produce. The rich did well after 2009 because they were in the stock market. A great portion of the underclass were not in the stock market. And you can think of all kinds of creative ways of redistributing money. At the end of the day, you simply still have to go after those that have and steal it from them to some degree. You can call it taxation, call it whatever you want. You have to steal it from them and give it to other people. And for example, you were talking about children in poverty. Every kid in this country now has access to almost unlimited student loans to the point where we've created a student loan bubble.
to pull these masses out of poverty. And that's fine. I don't have any problem with that. But at some point in time, it all goes bad because you can't get enough from the producers, and the producers simply say, that's it. I'm out. I'm done. So you can keep calling it new names.
Yeah, yeah. So what about that, Joseph Stiglitz?
Well, first, let me take up the first point about the fact, one of the reasons that the wealthy did so well in the years after the crisis, because they were in the stock market, and the stock market went up so high. This is an example of, again, you might call it a distorted role of public policy that wasn't adequately focused on inequality. What we had is a monetary policy that was focused on low interest rates that hurt retired people who had been prudential and put their money in government bonds. So they suffered. But the low interest rates created a stock market bubble that advantaged the very rich. So it was a matter of public policy that we created this kind of distortion. There were other things they could have done. For instance, one of the things that they could and should have done is to make sure that the liquidity that they were creating actually did what it was supposed to do, which was to create new jobs, to go to small and medium-sized enterprises that would be able to expand and create new jobs. The fact was, years after the crisis began, lending to small and medium-sized enterprises was down more than 20% from the level that it was before the crisis. So these were young entrepreneurs, entrepreneurs throughout the country who simply couldn't get the money. Money was being channeled to the big companies, not to the small companies. Meanwhile, when we went and bailed out the bankers, you know, it was clear that we had to save the banks, but we didn't have to save the shareholders, the bondholders, and the bankers. When we bailed out the banks, we focused on the big banks, but we let the smaller banks, very important to our communities throughout the country, go down the tubes. And the result, again, was that we had blocked the channel of credit. Meanwhile, the mortgage market became more concentrated. And so even when the interest rates fell, it became very difficult for many Americans to refinance their home, to get mortgages that take advantage of it. So this is just one example of how the way the game is stacked against ordinary Americans.
Let me hold you there.
Towards the very top.
We have a break that we need to take, and we'll pick up on another point that our caller made about if we tax the rich more, or as he put it, steal from the producers more, that they are going to say, I'm out of here. We'll pick up on that point and take more of your calls. For the author of The Great Divide, Unequal Societies and What We Can Do About Them. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about economic inequality in the U.S., the growing gap between the very rich and the very poor. Our guest is Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. He is the author of several books. His latest is The Great Divide, Unequal Societies and What We Can Do About Them. We're welcoming your thoughts on what we can do about the Great Divide, if anything, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And again, our caller before the break said that if we start taxing the rich more, he said stealing from the producers more, that the producers are, I don't know, going to leave, I guess. Or maybe this is a disincentive to be rich, Joseph Stiglitz.
I think it gets it exactly wrong. First of all, you have to understand how it is that so much of the wealth at the top gets created. And let me just give you an example. During the Bush administration, we passed a very important bill, which was called Part D, which provided prescription benefits to the aged. But in that bill, there was one sentence buried into the bill that made a very big difference. It said that the U.S. government, the largest purchaser of drugs in the world, could not bargain with the drug companies. The result of that was an annual gift estimated to be over $100 billion to the drug companies. In other words, the drug companies were stealing from us. Now, this is even getting worse. The new trade agreement that President Obama has proposed, the TPP, proposes to make things even worse by making it more difficult for generics to compete with brand name drugs and extend the effective patent life. So these are examples where the rules of the game create monopoly power, create market power that transfer money from ordinary citizens to the people at the very top. When we look more carefully at this idea, are the people at the top really the job creators? My view is very different about this. There's enormous creativity across the American economy. The real reason that there isn't more job creation is the fact that there's inadequate demand. When we look very carefully at things like that the Bain, Mitt Romney's company did, you look carefully what they did. They were more involved in job destruction than job creation. And a lot of these gifts, special provisions, special tax provision, provide incentives for corporations to move jobs out of the United States abroad. So if we had a fair tax system and a better design tax system, we would actually have better incentives for creating jobs in the United States. American companies are sitting on trillions of dollars, much of that held abroad. And it is not overregulation, it is not overtaxation that is keeping that money away from the United States.
Let's take a call from Larry in Partyville. Hi, Larry. Oh, Larry, that's too bad that you decided to hang up right when I went to you. You know, he was going to bring up...
Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, there you are. You had us on mute or something, Larry. Go ahead.
With Citizens United, you know, allowing like the Koch brothers to buy the election in Wisconsin for Scott Walker and his draconian ways of cutting teachers' salaries and public workers' salaries didn't help anything. I think that there should be a law that any money that's given to a political party or person, 50% of it should be taxed and put towards the national debt. And then that would expose the people giving the money, and it would be a patriotic thing to bring down the national debt, which would be good for everyone.
All right. Thanks, Larry. We'll get a response to your idea from Joseph Stiglitz, but I guess I wondered if you had any thoughts on, as well, the Koch Industries, the Koch brothers, promising to spend maybe $1 billion in the upcoming presidential election, and also this week praising Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin as being their favorite for president.
Well, I think what it raises is the fundamental issue that when you have as much economic inequality as we have in the United States, that economic inequality almost inevitably gets translated into political inequality. And that political inequality then reshapes our economy, reshapes it, not surprisingly, in a way to create even more economic inequality. In the United States, it's even worse because they use that then political power to change the political rules to give them to ensure that their economic power gets amplified in the political process. And Citizens United is a beautiful example of that. Unbridled spending for corporations that enables the rich to distort our political system. And that's why in the very beginning of our show I talked about how this economic inequality, this great divide, is undermining our democracy. We're moving to a system that is, I think, better described as $1, one vote, than one person, one vote. The result of this is, of course, that ordinary citizens feel discouraged. They feel that their vote doesn't count. The result of that is America has lower voter turnout than almost any other democracy. And that, of course, then weakens our democracy. It's a vicious circle, gives more power to money. And that's the trap that we're in. So unless we can go after our economic and political inequality, I'm afraid that we're going down a path that will see our society become more and more divided.
Yeah. So what do we do, overturn Citizens United or tax the contributions, as our caller suggested?
Well, there are many ways that we could go about this. I think one of the reasons why these elections are so important and why I'm so concerned about the lack of voter turnout is that we need to get a Supreme Court that recognizes that the rules of the game do matter, that this is that things like the Citizens United, the corporate contributions are corrupting our political system, that when companies make what are called campaign contributions, they're not really viewing this as a contribution. They're viewing this as an investment from which they expect and unfortunately do get a return. The banks got a higher return from their political investments than they did from any of their other financial investments. You know, those were a disaster, but their political investments gave them an enormous return. There are a couple of other things, though, that we can do. I think one of the things in the case of Citizens United and corporations, we should say just a simple rule that you have to have a shareholder vote before you make a campaign contribution. After all, you're taking your shareholders' money. Many of your shareholders may not agree with that. So let's make sure that what the company is doing is not reflecting the particular interest of the CEO. And the CEOs often like the kind of system that we have, which gives them the power to amplify their income, to take a larger and larger share of the corporate pie. But let's make sure that the real owners of the firm, the shareholders, get a say in what the corporation is doing with its money. So that would be one change. It could be done even within the context of Citizens United. And a third approach is the one that the caller suggested. Let's do something to disincentivize these kinds of campaign contributions. And one of the things that I think part of the disincentivizing is to try to make sure that we have a level playing field in the marketplace of ideas, in the political marketplace. So one idea that some states have suggested is that let's try to make sure that the second or third candidates have almost as much money as the guy who gets the most money. And so through public support, we try to create really a fair dialogue, a fair marketplace of ideas in the political sphere. We do this in a limited way in our media, where we say if one person gets a certain amount of media time, we say you have to equalize that by giving other people equal time. But we could do that much more broadly.
Let's go to Joe in Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Noam Chomsky published a book, and a film was made out of it some years back, called Manufacturing Consent. And one of the major problems, I think, in this country is we have probably the worst media of any developed country in the world. I must say that public radio is an exception, but it's more of a voice crying in the wilderness. I mean, the media in this country is controlled by about five, six corporations. They really decide what gets on the air, what Americans get to hear. Much of the media is bread and circuses. It's entertainment. We only have to look at the news that supposedly is called news is largely just entertainment on many of the airwaves. And I think Americans become more and more dumbed down as to the situation in this country. I mean, your guest has been pointing out so many issues of why things are wrong and how they need to be changed. But outside of a program like this, no one hears about them.
Right. Well, what about that, Joseph Stiglitz?
Well, this reflects what I said a few minutes ago. We need to have a more equal marketplace of ideas. And unfortunately, the way our system works, that those with money are able to do a much better job of airing their perspectives than others, and NPR is an important exception to that. This can have real, real consequences for how our society functions. You know, one of the dramatic moments where that became so clear was during the Iraq War and the lead up to the Iraq War, where even leading American newspapers like the New York Times were giving totally distorted news, partly because they were under such pressure, partly because many advertisers perhaps said, we will withdraw our ads if you're to newspapers who seemed, they allegedly, unpatriotic. It was only newspapers abroad like The Guardian and the Financial Times that said, look at what's going on in this war, what's going on in Iraq has nothing to do with what the Bush administration is saying going on. So the American population got a totally distorted view. We now know that.
Right. And I'm going to jump in because we're almost out of time, and we've been Chaz in Oneida is going to be our last caller to kind of tie a bow on this. Hi, Chaz.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. Yes, we're almost out of time.
Okay. Thank you. Some say that America is still an experiment, so that's one whole issue of where do we go from here. But I'd like to comment to the fact that it seems like the discourse is so prejudiced, it's really hard to get the facts. And we come up with partisan solutions, which are not really solutions, it seems. I appreciate your comment to that.
Yeah, I guess you said, how do we come up with an agreement?
Yeah, with the fact, and as you say, the first thing is to try to get an agreement about what the facts are. And in the area of inequality, in the area of the subject of my book, The Great Divide, the facts are now pretty clear. Everybody understands that we have become the advanced country with the highest level of equality among the countries with the least equality of opportunity. When you look at that and you look at how we created this inequality, it actually, the prescriptions of what we need to do become pretty clear. There's no single bullet, no magic bullet, but there are lots of things which together would actually make us a less divided economy, less divided society.
And they are described in the book. Thank you very much for being with us. Joseph Stiglitz is the author of The Great Divide, Unequal Societies and What We Can Do About Them. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster and to Caleb Lato for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. Join us tomorrow at this time for The Week in Review. Two guests from different perspectives talking about the top news stories of the week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.